parade ground. Stevenson's speeches were carefully written gems, suited for a university lecture hall. Eisenhower relied on clichés and leaden one-liners. Stevenson quoted St. Francis of Assisi, Thomas Jefferson, Lincoln, even Christ himself. Was he too sophisticated for American politics? His liberal supporters didn't seem to mind. He lighted up the sky like a flaming arrow, his young aide George Ball remembered. Republicans, by contrast, did not rely on oratory. They had a blunt election slogan, "Time for a change." After 20 years of Democratic rule, this resonated. Indignation, observed Revere, was the emotional keynote of Eisenhower's campaign. Allegations swirled around Truman's administration that a New Deal agency, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, had been approving loans in return for political favors. Republicans cried foul, condemning corruption in high places. They bemoaned bloated federal budgets and expansive bureaucracy, reviled Truman's alleged failure to combat communist subversion at home, and denounced the stumbling diplomacy that had lost China and invited North Korean aggression in June 1950. Senator Carl Mundt of South Dakota tried to summarize the case against the Democrats in a scientific formula. K1, C2, Korea, communism, and corruption. Eisenhower chose to make the Brown Palace Hotel in Denver his headquarters, the better to stress his Western roots and to escape to the mountains for an occasional weekend. From there he would make forays across the country by train on the elaborately decorated Eisenhower Special. 24 Pullman cars crammed with 150 aides, journalists, bodyguards, a teletype machine, and Ike's personal physician, Brigadier General Howard Snyder. The Denver staff and the campaign train were tightly managed by Sherman Adams, the taciturn New Hampshire governor with cropped white hair, a natty bow tie, and razor-sharp elbows, who brooked no guff from anyone and kept a close hand on the reins. Robert Cutler, a Boston bank president who had served under Secretary of War Henry Stimson and Army Chief of Staff George Marshall during the war, rising to the rank of general, vetted policy papers and speeches and later became Eisenhower's first national security advisor. James Hagerty, a seasoned reporter for the New York Times, signed on as press secretary. Back in New York, a large staff of advisors, speechwriters, researchers, and typists, as well as political hacks, mostly from the Dewey machine, took over the 9th floor of the Commodore Hotel under the loose direction of Herbert Brownell. They produced countless speeches and briefing papers cabled across the country to the Eisenhower campaign train. Eisenhower covered 20,000 miles by rail and flew 30,000 miles across the country, visiting 45 states and 232 towns and cities. In every town where he appeared, an advance team arrived many hours before in a giant truck labeled the Eisenhower Bandwagon. From this emerged an Army surplus jeep with a shrieking sound system that blared out "I Like Ike" songs and broadcast the message that Eisenhower would soon be passing through town. The campaign used new technology, saturating the airwaves with pioneering television commercials. Eisenhower, who grumbled about it, made a series of short ads in which citizens asked him questions about high prices, taxes, military preparedness, and more. Viewers would then see Eisenhower respond directly with a few lines of campaign boilerplate, always ending with, "It's time for a change." Stevenson, facing this well-funded, media-savvy Eisenhower juggernaut, needed to attack early. He went after one of Ike's most tender spots, asking whether he condoned the shameful behavior of the Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy, who for over a year had been attacking the distinguished public servant and war hero George Marshall. McCarthy, along with William Jenner of Indiana and a few other zealots in the Senate, alleged that Marshall, as Truman's envoy to China after the war, bore responsibility for the loss of China to the communists. Marshall's actions were so inept, they claimed, and so beneficial to the communists, that the only explanation was treason. The wartime chief of staff alleged McCarthy was part of a conspiracy spun from Moscow. Only after great prodding by the press did Eisenhower make a statement, rather impromptu, about his former boss. He told a press conference in late August, "General Marshall is one of the patriots, and anyone who has lived with him, worked with him as I have, knows that he is a man of real selflessness." There was nothing of disloyalty in General Marshall's soul. However, when pressed by reporters if this implied a rebuke to McCarthy, Eisenhower said he would not discuss personalities and would support all Republican candidates for election to ensure Republican control of Congress, even if he did not agree with all their methods. That meant supporting McCarthy and Jenner for re-election. And worse, in September, Eisenhower spoke at Butler University in Indianapolis, where he delivered a sharply partisan speech and allowed Jenner, who had called Marshall a frontman for traitors and a living lie, to stand next to him, clasping his arm while waving to the crowd. For a man who claimed to dislike politics as a profession, Eisenhower certainly leaned into campaigning. His speeches were combative, vague on policy proposals, and full of biting criticism of the Democrats. In Joliet, Illinois, on September 15th, he reminded his audience, "We are waging a crusade. A crusade to get out of the governmental offices, not only these people who are tempted by money, but the people who have been venal enough and weak enough to embrace communism and still have found their way into our government. Let's get rid of them." Journalist Marquis Childs observed that Ike enjoyed making these blunt and even brutal denunciations of the Truman administration that draw cheers from orthodox Republicans. Thin on substance, Ike's speeches thrilled his crowds anyway. Cudlow said that on the campaign trail he saw an extraordinary personal intercommunication between Ike and the voters. People who saw in the flesh the candidate's tall, straight figure and ruddy, smiling face, and who heard from his own lips his straightforward, unoratorical talk, caught again something they remembered from their youth. He didn't quip. He didn't sound erudite. He was like a member of the family. The effect was noticed by the press. "Eisenhower's stock is rising," observed Roscoe Drummond of the Christian Science Monitor. "Ike is no fancy orator, and he occasionally will trip over his syntax. But his audiences were huge, sympathetic, and starstruck. He is good on the hustings not because of what he says or the way he says it, but because he projects a dedicated personality. More than one listener has remarked to me after a rally, 'That man sure is sincere.'" 4. And then, just as the campaign was gaining momentum, Eisenhower's running mate threw a wrench into the gears. On September 18th, the New York Post revealed that Senator Nixon had established a fund into which wealthy California backers had occasionally deposited contributions. The money was used to cover the cost of campaigning and disseminating political material. The sum involved was not large, about $18,000, and the fund was not illegal. It soon emerged that Adlai Stevenson also had such a fund, but one of the legs of the Republican K1C2 tripod was the cry of corruption, and Nixon's fund looked dubious. Eisenhower did not like surprises, and this was a nasty one. Whatever its legal status, the fund was a political disaster. It conjured up the cartoon-like image of a band of unnamed wealthy backers handing sacks of cash to a young congressman in return for political favors. After all, such an image squared with the very picture Nixon himself had been painting of corruption in Washington. The fund crisis swiftly brought to the surface the subterranean divisions within the Republican Party. The Taft men, who were still in control of the party machinery, insisted that the story was nothing but a left-wing smear, in Carl Mundt's words. Herbert Hoover was roused from his slumbers to offer stalwart praise for Nixon's integrity. GOP Chairman Arthur Summerfield gave Nixon his full support. But the men in Ike's inner circle, the pros in New York, reacted with grave concern. Brownell, Clay, Dewey, they wondered if they'd bought a pig in a poke. The official organ of liberal republicanism, the Herald Tribune, whose publisher, Bill Robinson, was Eisenhower's boon companion, immediately put out an editorial calling for Nixon to step down. Privately, Robinson told Eisenhower that Nixon's place on the ticket seriously blunts the sharp edge of the corruption issue and burdens you with a heavy and unfair handicap. Yet Eisenhower worried that dumping Nixon might do more damage to his candidacy. He directed Paul Hoffman, an old friend who was now head of the Ford Foundation, to undertake a careful investigation of Nixon's records with the help of the accounting firm Price Waterhouse. He asked Nixon to release all documents relating to the fund. The senator would have to be clean as a hound's tooth in order to continue the fight against corruption. A remark that, when reported to Nixon, struck him like a punch to the solar plexus. "I told the press, I believe Dick Nixon to be an honest man," and then clammed up, awaiting developments. To hedge his bets, he alerted California's other senator, William Noland, to join the campaign train in case he was needed to replace Nixon. If Eisenhower assumed Nixon would immediately offer to step off the ticket, he was wrong. Nixon showed what would become his trademark resilience and refused to be bullied. He believed there was nothing illegal or unethical about the fund. He wanted to tell his story, and he had support within the Taft-dominated Republican National Committee, which swiftly raised the money to buy half an hour of television time so Nixon could explain himself. The campaign headquarters approved the television appearance, but Governor Dewey, calling Nixon from New York just minutes before his televised speech, told him that the campaign staff expected him to offer his resignation at the conclusion of the broadcast. Nixon refused. Instead, he gave a performance on September 23rd that rescued his political career from almost certain destruction. Known as the Checkers speech for its unctuous reference to the Nixon family dog, it was a landmark in modern American political history. Its most notable feature was that it was broadcast live on television and that 60 million voters watched it. Nixon spoke from the El Capitan Theater in Hollywood. The stage had been decorated to look like a middle-class sitting room, with bookshelves and drapes and a plush armchair in the corner on which his young wife, Pat, reposed in mute admiration. The senator, looking thin and pale, sat at a desk and faced the camera, speaking slowly, with quiet emphasis. His integrity had been questioned, Nixon began, and he wanted to reply. He had a theory that the best and only answer to a smear is to tell the truth. He explained the need for the fund as a simple expedient to spare the American taxpayer the cost of supporting his political activities. He pointed to the audit that had been done and said it showed that he had not taken a dime for himself. His conscience was clear. He continued with a pathetic accounting of his modest finances, enumerating his income, debts, mortgage payments, even the value of his 1950 Oldsmobile. Nixon summed up with a sigh, "Well, that's about it. That's what we have, and that's what we owe. It isn't very much, but Pat and I have the satisfaction that every dime we've got is honestly ours. Except, of course, for the dog, Checkers, which had been a gift to the Nixon daughters from an enthusiastic Texan. Regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep it." Then Nixon went on the attack. He noted acidly that Governor Stevenson, who had inherited a fortune from his father and never had to worry about money, also had a political fund and had revealed nothing about it. Senator Sparkman, the Democratic vice presidential candidate, had bilked the taxpayers by putting his wife on the federal payroll. The establishment newspapers had attacked Nixon when he went after Alger Hiss and were attacking him now. Above all, President Truman allowed corruption to thrive in his administration, while thousands of fine young American men died in Korea. It was natural that such people would want Nixon out of the way. That they would use smears to silence me, to make me let up. Well, they just don't know who they're dealing with. Nixon would not give up. "I'm not a quitter," he insisted. Defying the directive from New York to leave the ticket, he asked his viewers to send a telegram to the Republican headquarters in Washington to tell them what they wanted. Watching the broadcast from a campaign stop in Cleveland, Eisenhower was furious. But although Nixon had disobeyed him by not offering to resign, Ike had to grant his running mate some respect for fighting. At the end of the speech, Eisenhower strode out onto the stage of the Cleveland Public Hall, where 15,000 people had been waiting to hear his previously scheduled address. The audience had just heard Nixon's broadcast through the loudspeaker, and the atmosphere in the hall was electric. Eisenhower knew he had little choice but to offer praise for Nixon. "I've been a warrior, and I like courage. Tonight, I saw an example of courage," he began. "I have seen many brave men in tough situations. I have never seen any come through in better fashion than Senator Nixon did tonight." The audience responded with tumultuous applause. Still, Eisenhower prolonged Nixon's agony another day by ordering Nixon, through a public telegram, to fly to see me at once in Wheeling, West Virginia, where Ike would be campaigning the next day and would render his verdict in person. Although to contemporary viewers the Checkers speech appears saccharine and insincere, colored by Nixon's wounded pride and class resentment, at the time it was hailed as an honest and above all gutsy demonstration. The New York Times ran a digest of editorial opinion from the nation's newspapers on September 25th, in which the speech was seen as a smash hit, and Nixon was described as honest and sympathetic. The Los Angeles Times, which had backed Nixon from the start, declared him an adversary of evil and a champion of right. The Dallas Morning News even styled him the sort of he-man who has made this country what it is. Hundreds of thousands of telegrams fluttered into the Republican National Headquarters calling for Nixon to stay on the ticket. His painstaking assessment of his debts and his modest income, combined with his antagonism toward liberal elites, resonated with millions of viewers. Nixon revealed an uncanny ability to identify with the financial insecurities and ideological anxieties of the American everyman, who wanted to see him rewarded. There was no way to dump a fighter like Nixon. For once, Eisenhower had been outmaneuvered. "You're my boy," Ike told him when they met the next evening in Wheeling. But Eisenhower's big grin hid the menace of that remark. Nixon had saved his skin and his career, but at what cost? Ever after, Ike would treat him with suspicion and a certain disdain. Nixon's failure to fall on his sword, his public pleading, his naked ambition, his almost painful self-exposure on television, all this repelled the proud Eisenhower. He could admire the way Nixon had fought for survival, but he could never trust him. 5. Just when the fund crisis seemed to be dissipating, the Eisenhower campaign stumbled again. In early October, the Eisenhower special rolled into the battleground state of Wisconsin, whose 12 electoral votes went to the Democrats in 1948 by a narrow margin. The state had a tradition of progressive politics, but in 1946, had sent Joseph McCarthy to Washington. Despite his controversial reputation in the country at large, McCarthy was popular in Wisconsin and seemed sure to win re-election. Eisenhower needed McCarthy's support. Even the moderate Republican governor of Wisconsin, Walter J. Kohler, who loathed McCarthy, found it necessary to swallow his principles and endorse the senator for re-election. Kohler concluded that a break with McCarthy would injure the party and possibly tip the scales toward the Democrats in November. The press was well aware of the friction between Eisenhower and the red-baiting senator. McCarthy had made known his suspicions about Eisenhower's faith in the anti-communist crusade, while Eisenhower was bitter about McCarthy's continuing attacks on George Marshall. Ike's New York-based team of speechwriters, representing the liberal faction within the campaign, urged him to use the visit to Wisconsin to speak out on Marshall's behalf, indirectly rebuking McCarthy. They penned a speech that, while full of harsh anti-communist rhetoric, carried several lines of support for Marshall. But those words would never be spoken. The night before Ike arrived in Wisconsin, McCarthy met him in Peoria, Illinois. McCarthy knew about the speech and asked Eisenhower to omit the statement of support for Marshall. Ike refused, outraged by the presumption of the junior senator. But the next day, when the train crossed into Wisconsin, McCarthy jumped on board and appeared on the back platform alongside the candidate. At the day's first stop in Green Bay, Eisenhower endorsed all the Republican candidates running for office in Wisconsin and specifically referred to McCarthy. "I want to make one thing very clear," he said. "The purposes he and I have of ridding this government of the incompetent, the dishonest, and above all the subversive and the disloyal are one and the same. Our differences have nothing to do with the end result that we are seeking. The differences apply to method." At the next stop in McCarthy's hometown of Appleton, the senator stood next to Ike on the back of the train and introduced the general as a man who will make an outstanding president. Inside the train, however, a fierce debate had broken out. Governor Kohler was urging the Eisenhower team to change the speech their man planned to make that evening in Milwaukee. The paragraph of support for Marshall would be seen as provocative, a slap in the face to McCarthy, and it would damage Eisenhower's chances of winning the state. Sherman Adams agreed, but the New York team was appalled. Why buckle under to McCarthy? Surely Eisenhower would win more votes nationwide by showing his independence from the toxic senator. To his everlasting regret, Eisenhower did, in fact, buckle, allowing his praise of Marshall to be excised from his speech. Why? The answer that is often given is that he was a novice in politics and didn't understand the significance of the issue. But nothing could be further from the truth. Eisenhower understood exactly what he was doing. To win in November, he felt he needed to shore up his support from the old guard and the right wing of his party. The moderates would be for him anyway. He would grit his teeth and appease McCarthy. That night in Milwaukee, Eisenhower delivered a blistering attack on the Democrats and the Truman administration that sounded very much like a speech that could have been given by MacArthur or Nixon. Unbeknownst to Eisenhower, however, his staff had released to the press the original text of the speech, including the praise for Marshall. Journalists who had been expecting a bold statement of support on behalf of Marshall listened in vain. Eisenhower's condemnation of the communist penetration of government, delivered in McCarthy's home state and shorn of any tempering words of praise for Marshall, left him open to a wave of criticism that he had caved in to the worst demagogue in his party. And so he had. Truman was roused to fury by the events in Milwaukee. He adored Marshall, and he was outraged at Eisenhower's decision to place party unity above personal loyalty. Truman decided to go on the attack. In speeches in Oakland and San Francisco just a day after Eisenhower's Milwaukee fiasco, Truman linked Eisenhower with a wave of filth that he claimed Republicans were spreading. The president spoke with unabated anger about his old associate. "The surrender has been complete, to the old guard, to the lobbies, to the mossbacks of every description. But it is more than a surrender. It is the tragedy of an able and amiable human being torn out of the life he was trained to follow and shoved around as a tool for others." The following day, in a speech in Colorado, Truman blamed Ike for appeasing these moral pygmies, Senators Jenner and McCarthy. "Such moral blindness brands the Republican candidate as unfit to be president of the United States." Hearing these attacks, Eisenhower swore that if he won the presidency, he would never ride down Pennsylvania Avenue with Truman. How low can you get? Truman's attacks compelled Eisenhower's speechwriting team to attempt to change the focus of the campaign away from McCarthyism and the Marshall Affair, and toward an area of strength for the general, foreign relations, and in particular, Korea. In Detroit on October 24th, Eisenhower offered his personal pledge to grapple with the ongoing crisis in Korea and to do everything possible either to win or to end the war there. If elected, he vowed, "I shall go to Korea." Here at last was a concrete promise to fix a problem most Americans cared deeply about, far more than communists in government. The comment infuriated Truman, who was in the midst of negotiating an armistice in Korea. But politically, it was a powerful move, conjuring the image of America's most successful soldier finally bringing an end to a bitter war. When reporters on the campaign train saw the text of the Detroit speech, they simply concluded, "That does it. Ike is in." On November 4th, Eisenhower won a smashing electoral and popular victory, amassing 55% of the vote to Stevenson's 44%. The electoral total was crushing, 442-289. Stevenson won only 9 states, all in the South, and he lost his home state of Illinois by 10 percentage points. Eisenhower even chipped away at the Democrats' southern stronghold, picking up Virginia, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Texas, and Florida, all of which Truman had won in 1948. At age 62, Eisenhower was the oldest man to be elected president since James Buchanan in 1856. The 1952 election was not Eisenhower's finest hour. He made regrettable mistakes on the campaign trail, allowing Nixon to outmaneuver him during the fund scandal, refusing to break with right-wing zealots like McCarthy and Jenner, and failing to rally to the defense of George Marshall, his mentor and a true national hero. His criticisms of Truman were acidic and hypocritical, given his own role in forging America's security policy under Truman's leadership. The campaign needlessly poisoned his relations with the outgoing president. But then election campaigns do not often bring out the best in politicians. And despite the gaffes and the overblown attacks, Eisenhower genuinely moved millions of Americans. Voters in 1952 were tired of Truman, tired of war, labor strife, inflation, big government, and the communist peril. Eisenhower legitimated these grievances because he shared them. His view of government was skeptical, distant, and wary. He urged voters to turn away from the material promises of the New Deal and return to a time of entrepreneurial spirit, to revive American traditions of independence and self-reliance. For Ike, the virtuous American was the businessman, the farmer, the innovator, the laborer, men who understood the value of money, men tempered by a decade of war and who drew sustenance from their faith in God and from the stern lessons of the marketplace. In addition to the message, Americans rallied to the messenger. Eisenhower drew people to him because he was indisputably a winner, a man touched by success, comfortable in command, unafraid of great responsibility. With some reason, Americans had come to believe that Eisenhower, invested with the great power of the American presidency, could change the country, and quite possibly, the world. Part 2. An Age of Peril. Chapter 5. Scorpions in a Bottle. Freedom is pitted against slavery, lightness against the dark. 1. On November 5th, 1952, the day after his triumph at the polls, Eisenhower slipped away from the hubbub of New York City in the company of Mamie, her mother, his press secretary Jim Haggerty, his pals Bill Robinson and Cliff Roberts, and flew south to the pleasant confines of Augusta National Golf Club. Here the president-elect spent 10 days playing golf, including a round with golf legend Byron Nelson, writing notes to his loyal campaign staff, and conferring with his inner circle of advisors, especially Lucius Clay and Herb Brownell, to pick the members of his cabinet. Clay would take no official role in the administration, but exercised enormous informal influence. Brownell was offered the post of Attorney General. Sherman Adams, the wiry and taciturn New Hampshire governor who had managed the campaign, was given a special portfolio, assistant to the president, a position later called Chief of Staff. Robert Cutler, a wartime assistant to General Marshall who had shown administrative genius during the campaign, took the post of Special Advisor on National Security Affairs. Cutler would lead an extensive beefing up of the procedures of the National Security Council and turn it into the most important decision-making body of the administration. The name of one cabinet nominee was already etched in stone. John Foster Dulles would be named Secretary of State. He had been a diplomat and lawyer for half a century and was a Republican grandee, an internationalist, and a leading anti-communist hawk with ties to both the Dewey and the Taft factions of the GOP. His imprimatur could be found on the 1952 Republican platform with its strident demand for the rollback of communism from Eastern Europe and Asia. Although a leading figure of the establishment during the campaign, Dulles had been sharply critical of Truman's handling of foreign affairs and the Soviet threat. Arguing that containment was passive and likely to invite aggression, he called for a more robust strategy to defeat the communist bloc. His personality seemed suited for the times. He was tough, self-centered, suspicious, insensitive. He could also be a bore, ponderous and Jesuitical, according to one biographer. Eisenhower respected his knowledge and experience, but found his lengthy interventions in the cabinet tiresome. More important, Eisenhower kept Dulles's hawkish instincts in check. Eisenhower made sure that Dulles was surrounded by reliable, steady men whose loyalty was to the president. He named General Walter Beadle Smith under Secretary of State, and Robert Murphy, a wartime colleague in North Africa and France, Deputy Under Secretary for Political Affairs. Dulles was a zealous and aggressive cold warrior in public. In private, he took his lead from Eisenhower. On Clay's advice, Eisenhower appointed Charles Irwin Wilson, the millionaire head of the General Motors Company, nicknamed Engine Charlie, to run the Pentagon. A successful engineer and industrial manager, his central qualification for Secretary of Defense was that he had led GM during the Second World War and had worked with the government to rapidly expand production of trucks, tanks, armored cars, and aircraft engines for the war effort. One close observer called Wilson bluff and hardy, a passionate and uncompromising simplifier of issues, fresh from General Motors with abundant confidence that his corporate experience in Detroit's automobile industry would guide his path through all snares of politics. Yet he was politically an outsider, and Eisenhower paid a price for picking a man with few political connections and no common touch. Ike later confessed that Wilson never found a way to sell himself and his programs to the Congress, and proved no match for the service chiefs in the Pentagon, who ran circles around him. Clay urged the president-elect to appoint George M. Humphrey as Secretary of the Treasury. Humphrey, president of M.A. Hanna, a large iron ore processing company in Cleveland with subsidiary interests in steelmaking and other industries, was jovial, earnest, Midwestern, and unaffected. According to one observer, he was a businessman's businessman, a pleasant, vigorous figure, working hard and playing hard, with a mind of impressive clarity, a passion for facts, and an assumption that New Dealism was spending the country into bankruptcy. Eisenhower came to like Humphrey personally a great deal. He frequently vacationed at Milestone, Humphrey's plantation in Thomasville, Georgia, where the two men enjoyed the excellent quail shooting. In the cabinet, Humphrey volubly intervened in debates, calling for less spending in every quarter. His stolid judgment and parsimonious inclinations played a major role in the administration. The Eisenhower cabinet, not surprisingly, felt and looked much like a corporate boardroom, though it retained accents of a military headquarters. For example, Robert Cutler, the National Security Advisor, maintained a formidable protocol when the National Security Council convened. According to one participant, Bobby would come striding into the room and in a stentorian voice announce, "Gentlemen, the President." Everyone stood up and Ike would enter quietly and take his place without further fanfare. Cutler occasionally tended to embellish this ritual and it was rumored that the president finally suggested that he moderate the pomp and ceremony. The cabinet epitomized what the left-wing sociologist C. Wright Mills called in 1956 the power elite, when he observed that power in modern America tended to flow toward a small, dynamic coterie of men with shared experiences, ideals, values, and ambitions. Through military service, corporate leadership, and government work, and sometimes all three, these men had developed a network of influence and connections. They agreed, as Wilson would tell Congress in his confirmation hearings, that what was good for General Motors was good for America, and vice versa. No one in the cabinet found such an idea objectionable. Nor would they have doubted for one moment the thesis that America was in peril, fighting for its life against communism, or that disloyalty must be rooted out of public life, or that government itself was something to be looked on with suspicion, an impediment to the healthy functioning of the free market and the pursuit of individual happiness. These men had not been brought into the cabinet for their diversity or heterodox ideas. Quite simply, they embodied the age of Eisenhower. 2 weeks after the election, Eisenhower wrapped up his vacation in Augusta and headed north. His first stop on November 18th was to call on Truman at the White House. There had not been an orderly change of presidential administrations since 1933, and both Eisenhower and Truman wanted to show the world that, even as the office changed hands, there would be basic continuity in government. But it was a bitter moment for Truman. When Eisenhower arrived at Washington National Airport, he was met by an army band and cheering crowds, and his motorcade wound through the city past 500,000 well-wishers. Standing in the back seat of a brown open-top Cadillac, Eisenhower raised his arms in the air in a V-shape and beamed at the flag-bedecked lampposts and banners hung across the streets, declaring, "Welcome, Ike." At 10 minutes before 2 p.m., he arrived at the White House. Truman did not step outside to greet him. The two men had burned their bridges during the campaign. In the Oval Office, Truman tried to make some idle chatter to warm things up, but, as he recalled in his memoirs, Eisenhower was unsmiling. Their conversation remained formal, touching on the many pressing international issues of the moment, such as Korea, Indochina, Iran, and the hydrogen bomb. Secretary of State Dean Acheson, Secretary of Defense Robert A. Lovett, and Secretary of the Treasury John W. Snyder made presentations to the president-elect and discussed setting up liaisons between the incoming administration and key executive offices. Yet Truman and Eisenhower remained palpably uneasy with each other. Truman later chalked this up to Eisenhower's inexperience, writing that Eisenhower had not grasped the immense job ahead of him. He may have been awestruck by the long array of problems and decisions the president has to face. Nonsense. The architect of Overlord was no stranger to daunting jobs. Simply put, Eisenhower could not forgive Truman for his outrageous attacks during the campaign, accusing Eisenhower of betraying his principles and of moral blindness, among other calumnies. A novice in politics, Ike had not yet developed a thick skin to shield him from the barbs of partisan politics. He was still sore, and it showed. Later that day, Eisenhower flew to New York City and the familiar embrace of the Columbia President's mansion at 60 Morningside Heights. For 10 days, he held meetings with a stream of Republican Party leaders, senators and congressmen, advisors and friends. But in the early hours of November 29th, under cover of darkness, he was ferried by car to Long Island and Mitchell Field, from which he departed for his promised trip to Korea. The offer to go to Korea had been one of the defining moments of the 1952 campaign. Now, in secrecy, General Eisenhower was going to fulfill his pledge. It is not clear what Eisenhower thought he would learn by going to Korea that he did not already know. The war was a bloody morass, a stalemated conflict that neither side wished to prolong and neither side dared to lose. The trip was logistically complex, a 10,000-mile flight via San Francisco, Hawaii, Midway Island, and Iwo Jima to Seoul, in the company of his old friend and now chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Omar Bradley, as well as Wilson, Brownell, and Hagerty. A second plane with a small team of hand-picked newsmen, sworn to secrecy, followed. The arrangements were handled personally by Defense Secretary Lovett, and ships and aircraft around the world were put on high alert. The president-elect stopped on Iwo Jima for the night and slept in a brand-new Quonset hut just a few yards from the foaming strand where so many Marines, storming this barren citadel, had been scythed down by Japanese machine guns in February 1945. The next morning, Eisenhower rode in a jeep to the summit of Mount Suribachi, passing remnants of Japanese entrenchments and dugouts. From the top he looked with reverence upon the black volcanic beaches below. The reality of war was a constant companion on this trip. Upon arrival in Seoul on the evening of December 2nd, Eisenhower's party drove from the airfield into the war-scarred city center. Seoul had changed hands numerous times in the seesaw battles of the previous 2 years, and it was a charred ruin. Hagerty was shocked by the hundreds of thousands of refugees crouched over cooking fires in the darkness and bitter cold. Block after block of what had once been buildings were leveled flat. The Korean Capitol building was all shot up, bombed, and vacant. Propaganda banners with slogans such as "Destroy Communism" snapped in the wind in the burned streets. Through this misery, Eisenhower's motorcade drove on toward a large university complex, now the heavily fortified headquarters of the U.S. 8th Army, whose commander, General James Van Fleet, welcomed the president-elect. In the next 3 days, Ike toured American military installations, met with commanders in the field, visited wounded soldiers, and ate army rations. He felt the sting of the bitter winter wind that made Korea such a misery for the soldiers and toured the battlefront in a light L-19 Cessna aircraft that allowed him to see the mountainous terrain below. He quickly confirmed his own hunch that this war could not be won without a dramatic increase in firepower, men, and risk. While in Seoul, Eisenhower met twice with South Korean President Syngman Rhee. The 77-year-old lobbied Ike hard for an immediate and aggressive attack on the North. An all-out drive to the Yalu River, the Chinese border, is the only alternative to break the stalemate, Rhee believed. Naturally, he had no desire for a permanent division of his country. Now was the moment to unleash a crippling blow on the North and unify the peninsula, under Rhee's leadership, of course. Eisenhower met these calls for a wider war with stony silence. He knew such an attack might trigger a global war with China and the Soviet Union, but he was convinced the present bloody stalemate must end. "We could not stand forever on a static front and continue to accept casualties." Eisenhower made it his first priority to bring the war to an end, either through an armistice or through an all-out drive for victory. For the long journey home, Eisenhower chose to take the 17,000-ton cruiser USS Helena, which he boarded in Guam. The 6-day sea journey to Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, afforded him some time to relax, play bridge, and meet with senior advisors. Dulles joined the party at Wake Island along with George Humphrey, Budget Director Designate Joseph Dodge, Admiral Arthur Radford, Commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, and soon to replace Bradley as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and speechwriters Emmett Hughes and C.D. Jackson. This floating presidential administration naturally aroused a great deal of comment and speculation in the press once the news blackout was lifted on December 6. Hughes recalled that Press Secretary Hagerty played up the portentous strategic decisions being made during this epic Mid-Pacific conference. There were broad discussions about Korea and the strategic options available to the new president. The general outlines of Eisenhower's first budget proposal were also discussed. But the cruise was principally a time for the chief players on the new team to get to know one another and discuss in broad outlines the goals for the coming year. Upon his return to New York on December 14, Eisenhower found a controversy brewing. Truman had labeled Ike's trip to Korea a piece of demagoguery in a press conference on December 12th. Truman also lambasted General MacArthur, the embittered former Allied commander in Korea, who had told the press that he alone had a secret plan to end the war. Truman demanded that MacArthur reveal the plan. MacArthur announced he would share it instead with Eisenhower. The slight was deliberate, and Truman seethed with anger and contempt. Eisenhower tried to walk a fine line. He accepted MacArthur's offer to meet and discuss Korea, though he privately dismissed MacArthur's plan, which was little more than an atomic ultimatum to the Reds: end the war in Korea or experience all-out atomic attack. Instead, Eisenhower issued a statement that was measured and restrained. There was no simple formula for bringing a swift, victorious end to the Korean War. He wanted a satisfactory solution and an honorable peace. And in the meantime, Americans would continue our worldwide struggle against communist aggression. Privately, though, he was furious at Truman for disparaging his Korean trip as a political stunt. On January 20, 1953, a cloudy and mild day, Eisenhower went to the east portico of the U.S. Capitol to take the oath of office. Truman, his sour and mute companion in their limousine ride down Pennsylvania Avenue, now stood across from him, his face unmoved and distant. Chief Justice Fred Vinson faced Eisenhower, holding in his left hand two Bibles, one used by George Washington in 1789, opened to 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 14. "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land." And Ike's own personal Bible opened to Psalm 33, verse 12. "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and the people whom he hath chosen for his own inheritance." Behind Eisenhower stood Vice President Nixon, who had been sworn in just moments earlier. Eisenhower raised his right hand, solemnly took the oath of office, and then turned to the gathered crowd. He had agonized over his inaugural address, working closely with Hughes for weeks to craft it. He started with a hastily written prayer, a telling overture to a presidency that would attempt to place piety and devotion at the center of American public life, then launched into a remarkably unmerciful 20-minute speech, keynoted by overtones of conflict, war, ideological division, and sacrifice. "Forces of good and evil are masked and armed and opposed as rarely before in history," he began, and continued in this somber tone. "Americans," he said, "faced a deadly and insidious enemy, who know no God but force, no devotion but its use. They tutor men in treason. They feed upon the hunger of others. Whatever defies them, they torture, especially the truth. The battle between communism and democracy was truly a clash of civilizations. Freedom is pitted against slavery, lightness against the dark." Americans would not shrink from the struggle against communism, he insisted. They would fight with full conviction of the moral rightness of the American way of life, and without compromise or appeasement. "We shall never try to placate an aggressor by the false and wicked bargain of trading honor for security. Americans, indeed all free men, remember that in the final choice a soldier's pack is not so heavy a burden as a prisoner's chains." Eisenhower preferred war with honor to peace with dishonor. "We must be ready to dare all for our country, for history does not long entrust the care of freedom to the weak or the timid." The great task of the second half of the 20th century was to wage freedom's battle and persuade the world to join in that struggle against tyranny. "This is the hope that beckons us onward in this century of trial," he concluded. "This is the work that awaits us all, to be done with bravery, with charity, and with prayer to Almighty God." Dark and ominous, Eisenhower's speech conjured a vision of struggle, conflict, and sacrifice. The Great Crusade, was off to a cheerless start. 3. President Eisenhower had reason to be anxious. His first year in office, and indeed his entire presidency, unfolded under the shadow of an intensifying arms race. Just 3 days before his election, on November 1, 1952, the Atomic Energy Commission oversaw the test of the first hydrogen bomb, to that date the largest explosion detonated by man. The device had been built on the coral island of Alugalab in the South Pacific and weighed 80 tons. The 10.4 megaton explosion, 500 times more powerful than the bomb that devastated Hiroshima, sent a mushroom cloud of steam and radioactive coral 100,000 feet into the sky. When the Soviets tested their first hydrogen bomb in August 1953, detonating a 400-kiloton bomb in the remote steppe of Kazakhstan, the world's peoples faced the no longer fantastical prospect that the superpowers could, between them, end human life on Earth. To drive home the strategic significance of these super weapons, the outgoing Secretaries of State and Defense, Dean Acheson and Robert A. Lovett, prepared an alarming report for the new administration. Their message must have made Ike's blood run cold. Despite its increasingly powerful arsenal of atomic bombs, the United States could do almost nothing to halt the Soviet first strike. As of mid-1952, Acheson and Lovett wrote, "Probably 65-85% of the atomic bombs launched by the USSR could be delivered on target in the United States. Only a crash program of investment in building a continental defense shield of interceptor aircraft and radar stations could help improve the nation's ability to survive such an onslaught." A panel of distinguished experts reinforced this chilling message. Chaired by J. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, the group arrived at some depressing conclusions. The time was very near, they predicted, when the Soviet atomic arsenal would be large enough to destroy the United States many times over. Of course, the Soviets knew that any attack on the United States would lead to their own certain destruction from a devastating retaliatory strike. Even so, the United States was vulnerable as never before to a surprise attack from its principal enemy. Oppenheimer's team concluded that the United States had to improve its air defenses to locate and intercept any Soviet bomber aircraft that might seek to deliver an atomic payload on American soil. The government also had to do a better job of informing the public about just what was at stake in the arms race. When Oppenheimer summarized the findings of the panel's report for publication in the journal Foreign Affairs, he penned an enduring metaphor for the nuclear age. "We may anticipate a state of affairs in which two great powers will each be in a position to put an end to the civilization and life of the other, though not without risking its own. We may be likened to two scorpions in a bottle, each capable of killing the other, but only at the risk of his own life." What was to be done? How should the United States wage the Cold War in an era of thermonuclear weapons? Should the president, in light of the ever-increasing power of nuclear weapons, pursue a policy of conciliation with the Soviets and propose a halt to the arms race? Or should the new administration intensify America's efforts to expand its nuclear arsenal, intimidating the Soviets with an array of fearsome nuclear weapons, and perhaps even pushing the Soviets into retreat? The dilemma shaped Eisenhower's first year in office. Secretary of State Dulles had no hesitation about which course to take. He counseled Eisenhower to adopt a policy of boldness in world affairs. The leading hawk in the cabinet, Dulles rejected Truman's strategy of containment as nothing more than a treadmill policy that offered no chance to win the Cold War. What was needed was a dynamic and active approach, combining nuclear deterrence. He spoke of hitting the enemy with shattering effectiveness, if necessary, with a determined effort to liberate the enslaved peoples behind the Iron Curtain. Eisenhower himself echoed these sentiments in his State of the Union address on February 2, 1953. The president declared, The free world cannot indefinitely remain in a posture of paralyzed tension, leaving forever to the aggressor the choice of time and place and means to cause greatest hurt to us, at least cost to himself. It was time for a new, positive foreign policy. Following Dulles's lead, Eisenhower denounced Franklin Roosevelt's wartime deal with Stalin at Yalta, which, according to the old guard, legitimated the Soviets' enslavement of Eastern Europe. The president also signaled that he would no longer restrain the nationalist Chinese in Taiwan and their leader, Chiang Kai-shek, from waging war against mainland communist China. The unleashing of the nationalists upon the communists had long been an ardent fantasy of the GOP hardliners. But on March 5, 1953, Joseph Stalin died, and the landscape of the Cold War briefly shone in a new light. Eisenhower, sensing an opportunity, asked his advisers, "Did Stalin's death open up the chance for a thaw in the U.S.-Soviet conflict?" Secretary Dulles and the CIA answered no. The Soviets, they argued, would remain just as hostile and aggressive under Stalin's successors as they had been since the birth of the Soviet Union more than three decades earlier. If anything, Moscow might be even more inclined to take risks now, as a show of strength during the transition to new leadership in the Kremlin. Eisenhower bridled at this unimaginative attitude. Perhaps naively, he hoped Stalin's death might create an opportunity for a new departure in world affairs. And the new Soviet leaders were making surprising gestures. Just 10 days after Stalin's death, Georgi Malenkov, who had stepped out from behind the Kremlin's cloak of secrecy as the leading figure of the new regime, expressed the hope of a settlement of East-West differences in terms unimaginable in Stalin's day. At the present time, Malenkov averred on March 15th, "There is no disputed or unresolved question that cannot be settled peacefully by mutual agreement of the interested countries. This applies to our relations with all states, including the United States of America." Such overtures merited consideration, Eisenhower thought. The world wanted peace. Perhaps this was the moment to seize it. "We do need something dramatic to rally the peoples of the world around some idea, some hope of a better future," he told the National Security Council. As he put it to speechwriter Emmett Hughes, "We are in an armaments race. Where will it lead us? At worst, to atomic warfare. At best, to robbing every people and nation on Earth of the fruits of their own toil." He asked his advisers to sketch a bold proposal that contained no double talk, no sophisticated political formulas, no slick propaganda devices. "Let us spell it out, whatever we really offer." He told his cabinet, "If we must live in a permanent state of mobilization, our whole democratic way of life would be destroyed in the process." Despite Dulles's reservations, C.D. Jackson, the senior advisor for Cold War strategy and psychological warfare, hammered out a plan of action for the president. Eisenhower, he argued, should announce an immediate offer to the Soviets to unify Germany, end the war in Korea, and place firm limits on armaments production. Jackson felt this plan would seize the moral high ground, put the Soviets on the defensive, bolster Allied unity, and quite possibly lead to an uprising inside the communist world or even a negotiated settlement to end the Cold War. The death of Stalin offered the greatest chance we have had in decades to move history in the right direction without war. If the president wanted a dynamic foreign policy, Jackson was ready with one. Eisenhower liked the idea of making some kind of opening gambit toward the Soviets, and over the next 4 weeks, he and Hughes prepared a quite extraordinary text that Ike delivered on April 16th at the annual meeting of the American Society of Newspaper Editors at the Statler Hotel in Washington. The speech came to be known as the Chance for Peace. In it, the president stressed the terrible waste of the superpower arms race and painted a picture of a world that could be turned toward more productive pursuits. "The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete highway. We pay for a single fighter plane with a 500,000 bushel